think it's on the day, it's about 25 years ago that I first met Art. And at the time, I was in Auburn, and he was teaching us about geostatistics with Don Myers. And that's the first time I heard about geostatistics and semi-variograms and kriging and all that. And it has been with us for all the time. So when asked to give this presentation, I thought this would be pretty easy. I'm just going to talk about, you know, variability and things like that. But then I realized that, you know, with the modeling that we're doing, that it's only recently that I start to learn about the limitations of some of these different models, but very complex models, different type of complex models, but very complex models. And realizing with that all these heterogeneities and spatial variabilities, and I'm thinking, we're going back to looking at what Art has been doing in his career, he knew that all along, and it's just recently that actually I myself start to learn about, you know, what actually, you know, you need to maybe simplify things a little bit more is what we're doing. So anyway, that's the title of my talk, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what I've learned. And maybe, you know, it all makes a lot of sense intuitively, but for us it actually became clear just fairly recently. So again, you know, we are all working on the lab, at least many of us do, and we are able to define these systems quite well. But really, many of the questions that need to be answered are at the much larger scale, at the base and the landscape scale. And again, you know, working in these regions, you know, we can apply the models, the very simplistic of the very complex models. We know the boundary conditions. We have the data. We can measure them and so on. But once you get to the field scale and you get to the, you know, to these scales, so what do we do now? And that it becomes a lot more difficult. And again, that's what we are. Many times we are increasingly more interested in. So in this case, you know, how complex do you make your model? So these situations that the boundary conditions are not, we don't have those as exactly as we want them. You know, of course, we don't have the data. There is a lot of uncertainty about all the parameters. Yet, we want to apply this model, and we want to know what the key hydrologic processes are and use them to simulate and forecast. So we're going to give a few examples about this. And I'm going to focus on salinity dynamics and hydrology. Salinization we've gotten to learn is actually not so simple. It's very complex. There's a lot of processes that are intertwined. Yet we seek the model that can actually simulate the key processes, and try to do that in the most simple way. So what we're going to do is we're going to show you some simulations using the UNSET CHEM model, and I'm going to use a very complex UNSET CHEM with everything in it to use as a benchmark, and then I'm going to predict it to forecast average salt salinity and salt load, in this case for a cotton irrigated field over 10 years, so quite long. And we're going to use this as a benchmark, and then we're going to simplify this model in various ways in terms of time and space scales and chemistry, and to see, you know, how well we are doing. And just to show you, and you all know, we are all familiar with these, so what in terms of what these benchmark simulations do, Richards equation and convection dispersion equation, solving this coupled with flow for each of these individual ions to then try to model the salinity and the chemistry. And this is all what's all going in there. So in terms of these benchmark simulations, we're looking at reaction systems, ion pairing, cation exchange, precipitation dissolution, and I should already point out that the simulations I show for, which relates to a study we did in the San Joaquin Valley, gypsum and precipitation dissolution processes are highly relevant. So that's really what we're trying to get to in the long term, what that does to salt and groundwater salinity. So, you know, and this is, you know, I'm not going to go into all this, but really what we have some benchmark simulations for different scenarios with deep and shallow water tables. And so it defines the boundary conditions and you know, over 10 years. And then, you know, deep groundwater tables being that there is leaching, and so there is much more a dissolution process, whereas shallow water table, you know, there is much more a precipitation process in terms of salinity. Okay, so don't try to read all this here. There's too much information in here. But you know, in terms of the simulations, are going to show various scenarios, with M0 being the benchmark. You see, with daily boundary conditions, 1 centimeter nodal spacing, cation exchange, calcite precipitation dissolution, complexation, gypsum, and so on. And then we're going to go from M1 to M5 at different simplifications, going to annual time steps, larger nodal spacings, excluding maybe cation exchange and precipitation, and so on. And then we're going to compare these scenarios, and then focusing on what is now actually the root zone salinity on the average after 10 years, and what is the salt load to the groundwater. And so what we find then, and if we compare, and if we then compare relative errors relative to that benchmark scenario, that is then, you know, these simulations where we actually go to annual time scales and grid spacings of much larger, that it really doesn't affect the end result. The error is insignificant. It's only when we start changing the chemistry, which maybe in this case is highly intuitive, but that's if we start omitting some of these processes, that we actually start making large errors. Okay, so maybe, you know, at these long time scales, not to worry about these boundary conditions and you know, and the grid spacings and so on. There's a lot of effort going into this, but maybe you're missing the point. Maybe you should focus more on these processes. So that's in case of, you know, looking at the complexity of the model by itself. But now, you know, so, but of course, you know, there is a trade-off, as in that's when the model input uncertainty comes in. And so what the question now is in the second example, in terms of how, you know, what is that trade-off, you know, how complex do we need to make the model so that in fact it's not that you can still account for the uncertainty, and that it's not overriding it. So this is this trade-off over here, as I put over here. And so what we're really asking ourselves is that complex models may be replaced maybe with simpler ones, and you can do that as long as the resulting, and that's the structural error. So that is indeed, you know, how does the simpler model deviates from the complex model, and that error is smaller than the prediction errors due to input uncertainty. And we define then the total model error as the sum of observation error, and I'm going to omit that from now on, but that's part of it, an input data error, and then is the model structural error, which relates to the model complexity. So it's the total error being the sum really of these two, and then the question is, how do these errors relatively dominate the end result, or affect the end result? So there are many advantages of these simple models, and you see them listed over here. We all very familiar with it, but the question then in the end is, you know, if you have two complex models, you know, it makes parameter identification obviously very difficult. So in terms of concept, thank you, Naftali. And this actually diagram is actually really the a summary of what we did. Is you can look at this trade-off between model complexity and data availability, and you see, like on the horizontal axis, you see the model uncertainty, which is inversely correlated with data availability, and on the vertical axis, model complexity, which then is related to the structural model uncertainty. Okay, so you know, more available data, going to the left would justify more complex models going in this region, but if possibly more complex models may be replaced by more simple models going in this direction, you know, as long as the structural error associated with it added simplification is smaller than the uncertainty. Okay, so you're getting in this region. Okay, so this is kind of like the domain, it's what you could work in, and actually what we'll then find is that really that is related to spatial scale. So maybe that is suggesting that the region of optimum model complexity, you know, is related to the scale, with small scales, you know, that we can use very complex models because we have a lot of data, so there's a little uncertainty, whereas at the larger spatial and time scales, you know, maybe suggesting that we need to use simpler models because the data availability is much smaller. So with that time, we're going to use HYDRIS to test that concept. So we're going to use a benchmark using very small grid spacings, where the model complexity and uncertainty is defined by the number of nodes in the vertical discretization. Okay, so we're going to say, well, you know, in terms of the simplicity of the model, we're going to relate that to how many node spacings actually used in the vertical discretization. We're going to use in a spatially heterogeneous field. This is defined by the coefficient of variation of infiltration. And then we assign input uncertainty to the number of measurements that we have, you know, to express that certain variability. Okay, so I call that little n in the next few slides. So that basically is the, in the model context, is the number of times I draw from maybe a partial distribution and a probability density function. And then the focus of this comparison is to predicting seasonal ET and soil drainage over the growing season. So this is then an example of the results that you can then do with this approach, where we have a relative sum of squares, which is basically you're looking at the total error, and you divide it up into structural model error, which is related to the model's complexity and its level, and the model input error, and it's the sum being equal to 1. So of course, when you know we have increasing soil space availability, you know the model input error will increase as that heterogeneity increase, and the relative the structural error will then decrease. If you increase the simplicity by reducing the number of nodes that we use to discretize the domain, for here in this case from 41 to 21 to 7 nodes, you see that increasingly the input error increases, and the structural model error will increase. And so, what they suggest is this: as the number of nodes is decreased, the structural model errors will become more important. Okay. So, a coarser grain model may yield acceptable, as underscored over here, may yield acceptable predictions in the presence of large uncertainty of spatial heterogeneity. So, a few more slides. This is another output of that. So again, this shows the trade-off between optimal model complexity and input uncertainty, where in this case the optimum is defined as the level of vertical spatial discretization for which the structural model input error, the structural model error is equal to the model input error. So these are 50%. And so you see here on the horizontal axis, the coefficient of variation of infiltration, and then in the vertical axis, the optimum of nodes, okay, that you need to use to reach that optimum. And so again, this is both shown for drainage and evapotranspiration. And what this shows is, for example, that as the uncertainty of the model input increases, okay, going from left to right, the required or optimal model complexity decreases. You know, so you see that the optimal number of nodes, you know, would actually decrease as the uncertainty of the spatial variability increases. This is then again is summarized in this last slide, which shows contour lines. The contour lines reflecting the optimum number of model nodes in this particular example required for a given coefficient of variation, and the number of points, the measurement points, and on the vertical axis. Okay, so for example, for a given CV, you know, this relates to the level of heterogeneity. You know, an increasing number of measurement points, say in the field, will be needed to justify the final correct discretization, which reflects the larger n. Okay. Or, for example, you can also say for a certain number of measurement points, a coarser model is justified as the input uncertainty increases, which is reflected by the increasing CV. Anyway, this and a lot of other examples are given in this paper, which was published last year in the VeraZone Journal. Thank you very much.